Studio 360.
If you don't know the work of the film director Jennifer Reeder, a good way to get a sense of her sensibility is watching one of her earliest short films.
A while back, in a time not so far from this time, there was a girl. A real young girl named Cherry. Now, Cherry had an uncle, Bruce. He was a funny uncle, if you know what I mean.
It's called White Trash Girl, the story, with a voiceover by the director herself, of an unwanted inbred infant who's flushed down the toilet, but survives.
Cherry's baby wiggled around in the sewer sludge for months. The ooze fed and nourished the baby. It made the baby strong. Real strong. I mean super strong. Her tiny baby body was becoming more toxic with every tiny baby breath and every tiny baby heartbeat. This little ball of nothing nice was turbocharged.
Living in that cesspool incubator gave the kid a superpower. Toxic body fluids she can spew at bad men.
Now our angel is all grown up, and she's waging biological warfare on any dumb fuck who asks for it. White Trash Girl is built for speed. She waits tables by day, raises hell all night.
Jennifer Reeder made her superhero the protagonist of three short comic bookish films in 1995, work that got her an MFA from the School of the Art Institute in Chicago.
She was born very much out of a third wave riot girl feminism that celebrated DIY. It definitely had that kind of spirit, that urgency.
After White Trash Girl, Jennifer Reeder built a career out of making short films for the art house circuit. So far, nearly 50 in 25 years, all punkish feminist stories about the lives of complicated women and girls.
It's because I am writing oftentimes from my own experiences and observations, but I look around at what is offered to girls and women in terms of media, whether it's advertising images or television and film. There's lots and lots of content about girls and women that, in my estimation, just isn't very authentic. And so even though my films are very particular and they have a kind of art house appeal more so than a mainstream appeal, I'm trying to fill in that authenticity gap.
She's now transplanted that basic MO into a feature film called Knives and Skin, which stars an ensemble cast of theater actors from her hometown, Chicago. It's the first feature she's both written and directed, and it's this semi-surreal exploration of teenage suburban life that people are calling the 21st century Heathers.
I call it a Midwestern Gothic teen noir. It's the story of a small Midwestern town where, right from the get-go, a teenage girl goes missing.
If you find something, stay with it and yell something as loudly as you can. If you find Carolyn, stay with her. If she's okay, yell, "I need the knife," as loudly as you can. If she's not okay, yell, "Give me some skin," as loudly as you can. If you get lost or separated or just feel like you need some help, yell, "Girls just want to have fun."
Carolyn! It's a teen film that borrows from various genres. It's kind of a horror and not. It's kind of a thriller and not. It's kind of a musical and not. Certainly, I want this film to be a kind of battle cry for young people.
Right. Well, and I was struck in this film that unlike the way teenage girls are so often portrayed in film and on television as these super precocious mini adults, these kids are kids.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even though the film itself is hyper-stylized between the dialogue, the performances, the lighting, the art direction, I meant for the whole film to feel as though it's hovering just above reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted the audience to feel seen and to feel heard and to feel connected to these young women and their stories and to feel validated in their own sense of a kind of daily survival. So part of how I think of this film as being, you know, kind of genre borrowing in terms of specifically horror is that sense of the teen girls' everyday fight for survival among peers or adults who just are hell-bent on making kind of one awful mistake after the other that does have impact on these young women. There's something about that everyday horror that I wanted to portray.
If you need some extra money, you could probably sell my meds to your friends at school.
I'm making good money on my own.
How?
I sell underwear.
Fancy stuff?
Used.
Yours?
No. Yours.
Do you wash them?
No. Nobody wants to buy clean underwear.
Who buys dirty underwear?
Builders, bankers, lawyers, doctors, dads. My history teacher.
And somehow the fact that it's teenagers, to me, makes sense that there's all these magical realist gestures, like a woman's shirt with a tiger on it. The tiger speaks to her suddenly, and eyeglasses glow, and wounds shine electric red. So that's what you mean by hovering above reality, which is not fully unreal, but glimpses of unreality.
Yes, absolutely. And I've used those elements of magical realism in my shorts, so I knew they could work. So when I started writing Knives and Skin, I didn't want to make a film that didn't include these elements that suggested that there is something very magical, for instance, about small-town America. And more so than that, there's something super powerful about teenage girls. So that's also why, you know, there's this sort of parallel universe in the Knives and Skin world, which suggests that there are places of synchronicity and harmony and utter beauty that is the flip side of what these young people are actually experiencing on a daily basis.
And speaking of that kind of uncanny synchronicity, you've got these moments through the whole film where the teenage girls sing suddenly choral arrangements of pop songs like Our Lips Are Sealed by the Go-Go's.
It doesn't matter what they say. In the jealous games people play, our lips are sealed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the singing moments, and especially these pop songs that get slowed down, like lullabies, lamentations, maybe perhaps even eulogies. The 80s part is part of my autobiography. You know, those are songs that I loved and most certainly put on mixtapes when I was a teenager. So I get to inject this film with some of my autobiography. But then a song like Our Lips Are Sealed, which is an infectious pop song, you know, you're rolling down the windows and singing to it. But in the rearrangement as it exists in Knives and Skin, it's really a song about solidarity and empowerment.
So when people come on, I like to ask them who their creative influences are. And you told us in advance that one of yours is David Lynch, which made total sense. But tell me more how you connected originally to Lynch's work.
I saw Blue Velvet when it first came out,
which is his great, weird 1986 movie with Dennis Hopper and Isabella Rossellini and Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern.
Sneak into her apartment?
Yeah.
Are you crazy? Jeffrey, she's possibly involved in murder. This is giving me the creeps.
No, just settle down. I have a plan which I think will work. There's very little for you to do, but I do need your help.
Exactly. I mean, there was something really special about the idea he presented that small-town America held the portals to the fourth dimension. And he pays attention to art direction in a really extraordinary way. I mean, he was an art school kid as well, so color and texture are deeply important to him. I certainly think my films have a more diversity in my small town. And I think I try to bring a kind of feminist or even sort of feminine sensibility to my films that I'm not so sure he's all that interested in.
Another big influence on your list is Lynn Ramsey, a Scottish director whose only movie I've seen, I think, is We Need to Talk About Kevin with Tilda Swinton. But the movie on your list is Morvern Caller, which came out in 2002. What is Morvern Caller and why do you like it so much?
So Morvern Caller, it's based on, I believe, a short story. It's a central character, a woman who, I'm not spoiling anything because this happens right at the beginning, whose boyfriend has killed himself. And then in the entire rest of the film, her both confusion over his death and her grief and her response, her coping response to the trauma is so unexpected and so remarkable.
He's gone. He's left me.
Oh, he's probably just in one of his moods.
No. He's really gone. He's never coming back.
Gone where?
Don't know. To another country?
Another country? You don't mean any sense. I don't know what you're talking about.
She is a female character who's so resistant and at times so unlikable. I mean, she's a very difficult woman, and both cinematically and in real life, I'm completely drawn to difficult, complicated women. And so Morvern Caller is this really astonishing, you know, character portrait of a woman in crisis, but it's deeply unexpected. There's no moment where she falls to her knees wailing, you know, as so many, you know, sort of grieving women do in films.
Another of the filmmakers on your list is the Belgian director Chantal Ackerman, and in particular one of her early films from 1975 called Jean d'Irmain, and then an address in French in Brussels that I'm not going to pretend to pronounce. It is an extremely deadpan portrait of the domestic life of a woman, right?
Oh, man. She's like, she really is like the original difficult, resistant mother. And that's a film that I saw very early on and was just astonished by the pacing, for instance. You know, the meatloaf scene, which I cite and which I kind of pay homage to in Knives and Skin. Mine is quite different.
The character, you see her making a meatloaf, and it's not just like for 30 seconds. You see her making a meatloaf.
Oh, yeah, it's in real time. It's extraordinary. I mean, imagine that, having to talk to explain to your producers that you need to use that entire something like 3.5 minute real time shot of her making a meatloaf so meticulously with the sound of the meat. It's a beautiful visceral scene with so much pathos, mm-hmm. and the sense of tension that's built up through that pacing and through these daily domestic activities. In a similar way as Lynn Ramsey's Morvern Caller, it's this very intense, very specific kind of portrait study of a woman unraveling, really. And it's so unexpected.
Your last influence that we have here is not a movie or a movie maker. It's the American fine art photographer Francesca Woodman.
I saw her work for the first time when I was in high school, which was a long time after she had died. And those beautiful, quivering self-portraits of a woman both willing herself into a space and disappearing into the space, vibrating in her environment or vibrating her environment. They were just astonishing. I'd never seen self-portraiture like that. And it didn't take much research after seeing the first image to understand that she had many years prior to that first time of seeing any of her photographs had killed herself at the age of 22, which like gutted me, you know? So realizing that you had this very young woman who made these extremely powerful, impactful self-portraits in a very short period of time, potentially all this kind of language leading up to her suicide. It's as though those photographs are like a long-term visual suicide note.
Right. And just to, so people are clear, they're black and white. There are a kind of degraded or messed up rooms and backgrounds. She's often nude. No, I hear you. And as you've just said it, it's almost like they're stills from a film that would end with her death by her own hand.
Yes, absolutely. She used this kind of a large format camera, and she would use these long exposures. So her image and the images of the other female models in the photographs are often blurred because they're moving. I mean, she made kind of ghostly images, but she is a ghost. And so, you know, when I was making Knives and Skin, I wanted to make a feminist film that had a missing girl at its center. So the trope of so many horror films is the missing girl or the dead girl, and that's a problem for a feminist filmmaker. But I wanted to take on that as an emblem or an icon, this kind of body of the girl. And so I thought a lot and looked back over all of Francesca Woodman's work to really kind of call on the spirit of those photographs.
And the way we've talked about your work and your inspirations in this film could lead listeners to believe, oh, that's going to be a bummer. Well, in fact, I finished the film thinking, oh, no, it's I won't say a happy ending, but kind of.
Absolutely. I didn't want to make a film that has so much darkness in it and leave an audience with no hope. There's hope at the end. And understanding that coming of age is a lifelong process, and there's never, you know, no one is beyond redemption, and there's a time and place for everyone to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes and move on from those mistakes. So everyone in this film has made a mistake or has confronted a burden, and we understand that even the most problematic of the characters in this film has turned a corner to make their life more stable and more meaningful.
Jennifer Reeder, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I really wish you the best of luck with this film.
Oh, Kurt, it was really great talking to you, too. Thank you so much for taking time.
Jennifer Reeder's latest film is called Knives and Skin. It's in select theaters, and it's streaming as well.